This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We'll have some thoughts for Father's Day a little later this hour, including the question of how the world thanks a pretty grim dad for helping make his child a timeless musical legend, Leopold and Wolfgang, later this hour. And some thoughts from the leaker who changed the course of history back in the 1970s, Daniel Ellsberg, on Edward Snowden and the NSA's surveillance revelations. We begin, though, with a changing situation in Syria, where the United Nations now estimates that nearly 100,000 people have died in that civil war. That's a tenfold increase from just a year ago. The U.S. now believes chemical weapons have been used by the regime of Bashar al-Assad on his own people. The White House made the announcement officially yesterday. This changes things for the Obama administration and has been enthusiastically welcomed by Republican Senator John McCain.
I don't see how you could possibly announce that you've concluded that Bashar al-Assad has used chemical weapons and say we're not going to do anything. My worry is not that he's going to supply him with weapons. My worry is that's all he's going to do, because that won't change the battlefield equation. The only thing that changes the battlefield equation is to take his air power out and establish a safe zone and get him the right kind of weapons, not the wrong kind.
Right kinds of weapons in a nation that has seen 100,000 people slaughtered over the last 2 years is certainly a term of art. And Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes tried to elaborate on that issue in an official conference call yesterday.
The president has made a decision to provide additional types of support to the SMC, which I cannot inventory for you, but which will be aimed at strengthening the effectiveness of the SMC on the ground.
To help us understand what kind of weapons are the right kind from the perspective of the Syrian opposition, let's talk to someone from the opposition. Amr al-Azam is a member of the Syrian opposition and a professor at Shawnee State University. Amr, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
What do you think of this notion of the right kind of weapons? What does the Syrian opposition need in addition to what John McCain calls an essential no-fly zone to up the ante in the battle against Bashar al-Assad?
Well, I mean, you've got to put this into the overall context of how things were. Remember, right the way through 2012 and into the beginning of 2013, we've had essentially a stalemate between the regime's forces and the opposition. The opposition have the manpower, but not the actual weapons to be able to essentially inflict a defeat on the regime. The regime has a vast arsenal of, you know, heavy weaponry, particularly air power and the long-range missiles, the Scud missiles, but not the manpower to deal with the opposition and essentially crush it. So when the regime started to receive the aid it needed, which is the manpower through the introduction of Hezbollah and Iraqi volunteers, that changed the game for everybody. And what now we need is to redress that balance back. And so you need to now provide what was missing for the opposition. And that's really the right kind of weaponry that would be able to neutralize the superiority of the regime. But there are two ways to go about this. You can provide these weapons to the opposition, or you can do it yourself. And by doing it yourself, we're not talking about boots on the ground. We're not talking about putting United States military personnel in harm's way. And I believe Senator McCain described that very aptly when he said, we can put holes in their craters. Aircraft need runways and they need air bases to operate from. You don't have to shoot an aircraft in the air to get rid of it. You can just neutralize its air base, and that would be just as good as shooting it out of the air.
All right, but let's focus on this just a little bit. You're essentially talking about anti-aircraft emplacements around a safe zone of the opposition, say around Aleppo, which would heavily arm that area with medium to long-range missiles to hit Damascus or to hit military emplacements. I mean, the civilian population must be terrified with the thought of that. And then the idea of wholesale proliferation of shoulder fire rockets into Syria puts us right back into Afghanistan, and we're looking at a possible blowback situation where many of these will go to Al-Qaeda.
Well, you know, we're not talking about throwing these weapons out there to anyone who's willing to take them. We're talking about providing these weapons to groups that have been identified, that are now known to be reliable, that we can work with, and that these weapons would be given to them. And it's possible to track these weapons. You can, you know, provide these in limited numbers in specific conditions. But if we don't feel comfortable with that, there is the other option of taking out these sites by ourselves. And that is just as viable and, in fact, probably more effective given the nature of the situation that we are in now. Please remember, President Obama declared that use of chemical weapons would be a red line for him personally. Okay, and that red line yesterday, we were told, has been crossed. So now you have the reputation not just of the President of the United States on the line, but actually of the United States, and the rest of the world is watching.
Well, so, we're definitely going to find out what that does mean. Amr al-Azam is a member of the Syrian opposition and a professor at Shawnee State University, reacting to the news that President Obama believes that chemical weapons have been used by the Bashar al-Assad regime in Syria, and that does indeed change the relationship between the U.S. government and the Syrian opposition. Amr, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The sound of Iran's hunger for democracy or some change in its government on the streets of Tehran 4 years ago this week. That was during Iran's volatile 2009 elections. This year, as elections approach, the mood on the streets and in the campaign is very different, or at least seems to be. Reese Ehrlich is a correspondent for the Global Post in Tehran. What accounts for the quiet on the streets in Tehran these days, Reese?
Well, the Green Movement of 2009 was brutally crushed over a period of months right after that election. But for the first time, the sentiment that gave rise to that movement has seen itself expressed politically as the reformists and moderates have united behind one candidate, Hassan Rouhani. And the excitement is quite noticeable in the streets of Tehran.
And excitement in the sense that this may be an orderly change to a very different Iran, maybe reminding us of presidents in the past who promised real reform but were squelched?
I don't think we're going to see serious change because all of the candidates, including the moderate, are well within the system here. But the reason that the reformers and the Green Movement people are rallying behind him is not unsimilar to why people rallied behind Obama. They were fed up with the previous administration. Ahmadinejad is quite unpopular here. People want change, and they're hoping that Rouhani will provide that. There's still very strong competition from a conservative candidate, and it's by no means clear who's going to win.
Ayatollah Khamenei has been described by Iranian expatriate commentators on this election as the longest-serving dictator in the Middle East. Do Iranians on the street have a sense of Khamenei as leader of the clergy in Iran as a dictator and that all of this election business is just something of a show?
I've never heard him referred to as a dictator, to tell you the truth, but he certainly exercises the unquestioned power. People often talk of him on the streets, of his supporters talk of him as a man who provides wisdom and guidance without actually having to get his hands dirty doing the day-to-day work. But there certainly are people here who consider him a dictator. The reason they don't say it is because it's very dangerous. A number of people that I would have talked to in the past were not interested in commenting because of out of fear of that kind. But what's happening is that within the confines of a very restrictive system, people are taking heart with these elections and are hoping that the movement that is pushing the moderate candidate will help open up some space for a bit more freedom.
Are there real issues in the sense that people talk about the expenditures on nuclear expansion at a time when the economy is in trouble in Iran? Or why are we spending so much money on Hezbollah fighting, the opposition in Syria, those kinds of things?
Well, there certainly are political issues in the campaign, and they have absolutely nothing to do with the issues that the U.S. is concerned about. The whole nuclear power program, support for Hezbollah and other similar groups, isn't even on the agenda. And frankly, most Iranians don't consider those to be important issues. The number one issue is the economy, and the U.S. sanctions and mismanagement by the government have led to 30-plus percent inflation and 20% unemployment. And those are the issues when I've been out in the streets talking to people. Those are the issues that come up. And what are the candidates going to do about it?
Do voters on the streets suggest that a closer relationship with the United States might get rid of the sanctions part of that problem?
Yeah, everybody wants closer relations with the U.S., and I think genuinely so. All the polls show that of all the countries in the Middle East, the Iranian people are the most friendly and look the most favorably upon people in the United States. But there's probably an unrealistic hope that if the new Iranian president negotiates harder, he'll be able to get the sanctions lifted. And when I ask them, but what if the U.S. doesn't change its policies, there's kind of a blank stare. Well, we have to argue harder. So everyone would like to have better relations with the U.S., but it's not at all clear on what terms.
Reese Ehrlich is a correspondent for the Global Post watching the election campaign in Tehran. Reese, thanks so much.
Thank you.
One of the people who reacted strongly this week to the revelations of government spying on internet and phone networks said this in the Guardian newspaper. In my estimation, there has not been in American history a more important leak than Edward Snowden's release of NSA material, and that definitely includes the Pentagon Papers 40 years ago. Snowden's whistleblowing gives us the possibility to roll back a key part of what has amounted to an executive coup against the U.S. Constitution. Those are the words of Daniel Ellsberg, the man who leaked those Pentagon Papers in 1971, who changed the course of history, became a fugitive, and then a defendant. I spoke with Ellsberg from his home in California earlier this week, where he enthusiastically compared his actions to Snowden's and Bradley Manning's, the young Army private on trial for revealing classified military information to WikiLeaks.
Like Bradley Manning, I was dealing with an ongoing war, which I felt was being continued, I think, as he did, hopelessly and at great human cost, with no prospect of any kind of success at all or any justification for the killing or the dying that Americans were doing there. I think Bradley Manning felt the same. There's a difference there from Snowden, who felt that the Constitution was being abused, that the Fourth Amendment was being violated every minute by minute and daily, and had been for some time, along with other things, and that would not change unless he took the initiative of revealing it to the public, who could act on the information.
Now, he can, of course, make whatever call he wants, and he'll face the consequences for it, as you did, referring to Edward Snowden here. But would you say that the war on terror, the idea that the U.S. needs to do something to defend itself against attacks that are out there, is fundamentally different from the battlefield war in Vietnam and the battlefield wars in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Yes, I think it was a mistake from the beginning to militarize it in the sense of calling it a war at all. What was clearly then and now essentially a police problem, an international police problem, requires the cooperation of police forces of all kinds of regimes all over the world, including, I'd have to say, some fairly unsavory ones, but also people who aren't inclined to cooperate with us. And that cooperation has been very seriously jeopardized by the militarization of the war in terms of drones, as in Pakistan and elsewhere. I think that's lowered our security. The examples that have been given just in the last week of supposed successes in this effort against terror turn out on closer examination to have been, in every case, almost due to police work and international police work, leads from the British police and otherwise, and not from indiscriminate listening to ordinary Americans, every ordinary American.
Do you think that technology has changed the game at all in the sense that this data does exist? It's not in a box somewhere. Part of the nature of the data itself is that someone is always looking at it.
Right. The temptation, in other words, is always there to gather that information and to abuse it in the sense, from a governmental point of view, in the sense of using it in all kinds of purposes, data on every journalist, on every source, on every congressperson, has an obvious, frankly, it's not a potential for abuse, it is an abuse. And the same is true for all ordinary Americans. The potential there for blackmailing them into being informants, as was done in the East German so-called Democratic Republic, the Stasi, the secret police there, as shown in the movie The Lives of Others, which I would like to see reissued right now, got the Oscar a few years ago for Best Foreign Film, shows that having that kind of knowledge of the private lives of every individual gives the state the ability to manipulate them, to threaten them, to promise them in ways that can turn them into a nation of informants, which, as Snowden has said, is not the kind of world he wants to live in, not the country he wants to live in. And I agree with him on that.
Now, Snowden has given no evidence that the U.S. has actually gone ahead and done that. I'm wondering if there's a fundamental difference between the kinds of surveillance that the Stasi did, and that they actually installed devices into people's homes and offices. In your case, devices were installed in your home and your psychiatrist's office during the Nixon administration, when you were bugged, is there a fundamental difference between doing something like that, which is a clear violation of property and your home and private places, versus simply taking a look at data that exists in this digital realm that involves no specific wiretap or any sort of affirmative action to listen in?
So why was the cooperation of these places like Google on the one hand and Verizon on the other so secret? Why was it such a secret that since it's so commonplace and ordinary and to be taken for granted, as the president and Dianne Feinstein now says, why was it a problem to reveal it? It's so ordinary. It's so obvious. I think that's ridiculous. And as Mark Udall and Ron Wyden have been saying now for some years, especially a year ago, they believed the public would be stunned to realize the breadth of this collection. And you're saying they shouldn't have been. Well, maybe they shouldn't have been, but there is a debate now. And the president says he welcomes the debate. Not enough, apparently, to have initiated it. But in fact, the debate that is going on now in Congress about these matters, or there are about a dozen ways in which investigations are now getting started, would simply not have happened without Edward Snowden's revelation. So I think we owe him a very considerable debt of gratitude.
Well, you make a great point on this idea that if it's so ubiquitous, the availability of this data, why was it made secret? It seems as though there are indications that Google and some of the other companies that were involved here want to get out from under that secrecy precisely for that point.
Well, they felt compelled, apparently, and it's profitable for them in their relations with the government in general. I think the investigations will show how sincere they are in their concern about it. We'll find out. Certainly, official statements give us no information whatever. As you know, the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, was asked by Senator Wyden in this March in Senate hearings, do you collect information of any kind at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? Clapper informed the public and the senator, no. Now, he's later described that, when Snowden's documents show the contrary, as the least untruthful statement he could have made. Well, a less untruthful statement would have been yes. That's sort of the long answer. No is the short answer. And he was not prepared to tell us that, despite the fact that it was also legal and so necessary. So apparently he was worried that the public would not find it quite as reasonable as he does, and that seems to be the case.
Daniel Ellsberg, former U.S. military analyst who in 1971 leaked the Pentagon Papers, which revealed how the U.S. public had been misled about the Vietnam War. Daniel Ellsberg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tickets, please.
Look up in the sky. Oh, I won't get started. It's movie day on The Takeaway Friday with Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer here to weigh in. Rafer, film critic for Newsday, Kristen, culture producer for The Takeaway. They're both from the Movie Date podcast, which you can subscribe to at moviedatepodcast.org. It's Man of Steel weekend here for Father's Day, Rafer and Kristen. You've both seen the movie, right?
Yes, indeed.
Absolutely.
Let's hear a clip.
You let them handcuff you?
Wouldn't be much of a surrender if I resisted. And if it makes them feel more secure, then...
What's the S stand for?
It's not an S. On my world, it means hope.
Well, here it's an S.
So Amy Adams is kind of a hipster who doesn't know who Superman is on this planet, right, Rafer? What do you think of this?
Well, I think this is an attempt to reboot Superman. It's the origin story again. Christopher Nolan helped write the story. It's not his movie. Zack Snyder directed it. But it feels like a little bit of a Dark Knight revisited. They're trying to darken, complicate this old-fashioned icon, update him for a modern world. I'm not sure it works. I'm not sure if I need all the conflict and all the brooding in this Superman. I like the old-fashioned do-gooder Superman.
Kristen, what do you think? Scrap metal, recycled, or stainless?
Well, as Rafer was saying, they are trying to make Superman a more conflicted character, not just a Boy Scout in blue, as the comic book nerds like to call him.
Imagine Christopher Nolan going for conflicted.
And here the central conflict is very suitable for Father's Day, though. He has his biological father, back from Krypton, who keeps visiting him in the form of a ghost. And then he has his father, played by Kevin Costner, here on Earth in Kansas, and his relationship between should I fight if it means hurting people, how are my alliances with my family, and so on. And I think that part is interesting, but overall the movie's pretty slow. It drags a lot. It's about 2.5 hours long. It doesn't need to be that long, and it's not fun, which is the biggest drawback. It's just not a fun movie.
You know, takes us back to the old Christopher Reeve movie. I thought it was such an irony that the Man of Steel became the quadriplegic who couldn't walk.
Yes.
He used to be able to fly. We sort of say goodbye to Christopher Reeve in this movie, and it's a very different Superman from that one.
Yeah, he's darker, he's more chiseled, he's more soulful, more sensitive. But you know, that clip that you played with Lois Lane and Superman, that's really the only banter you get between them in this film. There's not a lot of romance in this movie, and as Kristen was saying, there's not a lot of fun and light and joy in it. It's a lot of this fashionable dark superhero. It's the new Hollywood pose to have your superheroes be dark, and I'm starting to not buy it these days.
We have special algorithms that can find banter in 2.5 hour Christopher Nolan movies. So let's move to This Is the End. Here's a clip.
In your travels, did you see anything that you would describe as apocalyptic?
I mean, no, but no. I would say it's completely obvious what's going on here. I mean, it's a zombie invasion.
I love this premise. Did you love this movie, Kristen?
I just loved it. I loved it so much. It was a whole bunch of celebrities playing fake versions of themselves that seem kind of like what we suspect they're like in real life, facing the apocalypse, behaving badly and maybe behaving well, and we'll see if they'll survive.
And?
I thought it was going to be a little too much insider humor for me, but I found that the meta jokes were mixed with enough actual jokes that I actually really enjoyed it.
And a really talented bunch. Before we go for Father's Day, movie dads that you loved, I'll give you mine. Albert Finney in The Big Fish.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah. I love that one. I love a lot of movie dads, but I'm really fond of Brian Mills, a man with a very special set of skills from the Taken movies.
Oh, nice.
I'm going to go with Wink from Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Oh, that's...
one of my faves of recent years.
Oh, that's a sensitive male. Sensitive male.
Indeed.
Sensitive male. Rafer Guzman, news critic for Newsday, Kristen Meinzer, Takeaway culture producer, both of them from the Movie Date podcast. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, John.
And now that unanimous ruling from the Supreme Court that human genes cannot be patented. Synthetic DNA, manipulated or copied pieces of the human genome are still patentable, though. The case was brought against Myriad Genetics, which owned patents on two naturally occurring genes associated with breast and ovarian cancer. Those patents allowed the company to exclusively administer breast cancer tests and set the price too high, according to the plaintiffs. Sandra Park is one of the attorneys in this case for the plaintiffs. She's here with us in the studio. Sandra, welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Congratulations on the victory. What do you think it means, and what was Myriad's argument for retaining its patents?
Well, it's a huge victory, partially because of the two genes at stake here, but also because thousands of patents have been issued on human genes. So not just breast and ovarian cancer, but a lot of other conditions, including Alzheimer's disease, colon cancer, and many other conditions we all care about. Myriad's argument was based on patent office policy, which was as soon as you isolate the gene, which simply means removing it from the cell in the body, you have patent rights on that isolated gene. So it does not matter if it comes from you or me or any of the millions of other people in the U.S. That moment of isolation is when the private property rights reached the gene. And so what the court said yesterday very clearly is isolating a gene, removing something from the natural environment, does not make it your invention. And that should have been, I think, self-evident to everyone. But the Patent Office has resisted that argument for three decades.
And the Supreme Court essentially says that isolating a gene is no different than, you know, taking a goldfish out of the pond. It's not anything you invented. It just is a goldfish.
Right. Just as you would not be able to patent the iron that you removed from rock, that's still an element of the periodic table. Or if a doctor removes a kidney for transplant, that kidney, once out of your body, doesn't become the doctor's invention. It's still a human organ. And I think that was the principle reinforced by the court yesterday.
What happens when synthetic genes go back into people for various kinds of treatments and then combine with other aspects of the human genome and become naturally occurring? Then they does then the intellectual property that produced the treatment, revert to this decision, and all of a sudden we're going to be back in court?
Well, our key argument here was that Myriad patented the naturally occurring genes, and we thought that was simply wrong. It undermined the patent system because you were patenting the fundamental element of human biology that you want scientists to develop. We certainly think that if you manipulate those genes to create new therapeutics, it's transformed. It's not the gene in your body. And other companies can invent around that because they can develop new therapeutics that compete with yours. But with the human genes, you couldn't do that. You couldn't access the fundamental element of human biology. And so that was our argument, that we were trying to restore the patent system by allowing patents to come on later parts of research and development, actual tests, actual drugs.
But eventually, all genes will become part of the genome, and it'll be difficult to determine what are naturally occurring and what actually are descended from synthetic genes.
Well, I think what we've been very focused on are the human genes that you inherit from your parents. I think, we're not yet at the stage that you're talking about. And so that, I think, will certainly present new questions in terms of what the courts will have to grapple with.
Probably a case you could take in your lifetime,
I would think. Maybe.
You're very young here. What do you think this means for patients very specifically?
Well, it'll immediately increase access to genetic testing for patients. We've already heard three companies announce that they plan to offer genetic testing on the BRCA genes, which up to this point they have been unable to do because of Myriad's patents.
Sandra Park is one of the staff attorneys for the ACLU, one of the lead attorneys in the Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics Incorporated, case decided 9-0 by the Supreme Court in favor of the plaintiffs. Congratulations and thanks, Sandra.
Thank you.
And now, folks, the shortcomings of radio. And the miracle of music. Oh, I so wish you could all be here in the studio and see what I'm seeing. That's musician David Fulmer playing, drumroll please, the actual violin of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. David, what were you playing there?
This is Mozart's Sonata for Piano and Violin in C Major.
And that is Mozart's actual instrument?
Indeed it is.
Earlier in the week, Mozart's prized violin and viola made it to the U.S. for the very first time. On Monday, they were played at Jordan Hall in Boston. Tonight, the violin will be played at the Austrian Cultural Forum in New York. And we just made history. Mozart's violin was played in a U.S. radio studio for the very first time. And we'll hear more of that in just a moment, right, David?
Yes.
Also with us is Matthias Schultz. He's the CEO and artistic director of the Salzburg Mozarteum Foundation, which owns Mozart's violin. Is David taking pretty good care of it here, Matthias?
More than that. We are very happy that David Fulmer is doing this. And more, he's himself a composer, and that's why he understands how to do this.
What does it feel like to play Mozart's violin, David?
It's absolutely extraordinary. The instrument itself is in meticulous condition, and we had a long discussion about this yesterday. It is unaltered, and to be touching a part of history is very significant, especially for a composer, especially for any performer, indeed, but it is a very special opportunity.
And how long have you had it in your possession? Has this instrument been kicking around Europe for centuries? Obviously, I guess.
Yes, the violin is in possession of the Mozarteum Foundation Salzburg since 1956. That was the year where the 200th birthday of Mozart was celebrated.
And before that, it was owned by some billionaire or an old lady who lived in Leipzig?
It was the sister of Mozart, Nannerl, who owned it until 1810. And after that, it got to a musicologist. It's called Trestl. And after that, he was in a family in Upper Austria. And then we could buy it.
Well, when did Mozart play this? What age was he when he played this instrument, David?
This is an instrument that really he developed on both as an instrumentalist and also as a composer. It's extraordinary. The reason I'm so fascinated with it and why I can't keep my hands off of it is simply because he composed all of his five violin concerti with it and the grand masterpiece, which is the Sinfonia Concertante. And structurally, in his career, it comes at a very pivotal mark, which is his departure from Salzburg. So it's very, very special.
And he learned to play the violin on an instrument like this or this exact one?
I'm not exactly sure if this is the instrument he learned on, but this was his mature instrument.
And he was a boy when he became a mature musician, so he was playing this as a little guy.
Indeed.
Indeed. And, because it is Father's Day, there's probably more than a little pain in that violin, because Leopold Mozart, his dad, wrote one of the most famous treatises on how to learn to play the violin and tested out a lot of that stuff on his little Wolfgang. Do you feel any of that pain?
I do. It's very interesting. I was looking actually at the dates this morning, and it turns out that Leopold's document, his treatise, was published the very year that Mozart was born, 1756. And so one has this sort of double historical perspective. We have the interworkings of that document laced within the developmental stages of his son, which is absolutely amazing.
Which is a very musicological way of saying that Leopold dragged the poor kid all over Europe and made him perform in front of princes, kings, and queens, right?
Yes, the instrument traveled quite a lot, and Leopold, I mean, he seemed to be quite strict, but in a very good way, obviously. And he said that his son was one of the accomplished violin players in whole Europe. And I think, it's fantastic to see what he achieved with that. And if you see that he wrote all the violins and he played all the violins on this instrument, this is more than moving, you know.
Well, I mean, Leopold gave us Mozart. I mean, Mozart was, yes, in later years, an undisciplined fellow who died young, who needed that discipline in the beginning to bring his gift to life. What sense do you get of Mozart's musical gift by playing this instrument, David?
It is extraordinary to play an instrument, of course, that was not only instrumental in its own performing, but within the compositional process, I think is important to realize in a situation like this. When I first laid hands on it yesterday afternoon at around 3:30 or so, the first notes, of course, were open strings, and one could hear the resonating values of the instruments, and it became immediately apparent that this was the foundation of the sonority that Mozart used for all of his string music, not just his violin concerti. So this is a very important document.
When he was hearing the melodic lines of some of those great symphonies with string parts, he was hearing this instrument. He was hearing this.
Absolutely.
Is this an Italian, one of the Guarneris or Stradivari or something like that?
No, it's an instrument from southern Bavaria, from the Klotz family. And this is a very famous area where violins are made. And yeah, it's a very, very good instrument. And the sound, the colors, it's really, really fantastic. And that's why we are so happy about this. Not just to put it in the museums, but it's also able to do great concerts with it.
Well, it's a beautiful gesture. And without me saying, watch your intonation, Wolfgang, or any of that, let's hear the instrument in honor of Father's Day, the gift that Leopold Mozart, the original stage dad, gave us. And David Fulmer will play Sonata in C Major by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, played on his very own Klotz violin. Gentlemen, thank you so much. That was really remarkable. Matthias Schultz is the CEO and Artistic Director of the Salzburg Mozarteum Foundation. David Fulmer, performer, will be performing on this instrument tonight in New York. Good luck to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you much.
For Father's Day, writer Denny Bouchard gave us some thoughts yesterday about his bad bandit dad.
Fatherhood is an extremely powerful thing, and I can't in any way deny how important he was as a father to me. I was obsessed with him. I wanted to go back, find my father. I wanted to rob banks with him when I found out he was a bank robber.
One of you gave us the bad dad movie suggestion of Robert Duvall in The Great Santini.
Okay, Hogs, I've listened to you bellyache about moving to this new town. This said bellyaching will end as of 15:30 hours. Will not affect the morale of the squadron henceforth. Do I make myself clear?
Yes, sir!
I know it's rough to leave your friends and move every year. But you are Marine kids and can chew nails while other kids are sucking cotton candy. And you're Meacham's. Meacham never gives up.
And then one of you reminded us of the mother of all bad fathers, Vito Corleone from The Godfather.
I don't apologize, that's my life, but I thought that... But when it was your time, that you would be the one to hold the strings. Senator Corleone. This wasn't enough time, Michael. It wasn't enough time.
We'll get there, Pop. We'll get there.
I think we're at a point now where we have to start to rebuild what our concepts of masculinity are. And also, I think probably more importantly, we have to rethink what our concepts of family are. And the way to start is with fatherhood, for sure.
Writer Steve Marsh's dad was not a mobster or a bank robber or a cruel violin teacher, taskmaster for that matter. Marsh lost his devoted father the same year he became the dad to a daughter. He says as a dad of a boy and a girl, he's still making it all up as he goes along.
Well, I think fatherhood has changed totally dramatically since the 1960s. I mean, the research that I was looking into it was just really crazy. You know, since the 1960s, fathers spent three times as much time with their children that they had before. The largest study of singles ever done last year said that men wanted to have children more than young women, which I found totally crazy, but it came from the largest study of singles ever done. You know, fatherhood is taking on this new kind of outsized importance in the life of men, and I think, you know, it's only really just now being started to be recognized how deep that change is.
And how, you know, how much you make and what your job is so unprepares you for that definition and, you know, search for identity as a father.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anything prepares you for it. I think as time has gone on, you know, the rituals that have been around masculinity, like what makes you a man, have slowly fallen apart. And for the most part, good riddance to bad garbage. But then, you know, what has come in their place has been being a dad and or having a dad, too. And, you know, when you ask men, like, when did you become a man, losing a father or becoming a father is right or 1-2 on that list. So, yeah, I mean, I think nothing does prepare you for it because it is sort of life, you know, it is the indisputable fact of existence.
Well, let's compare those two experiences. I've had one of them. I suspect you've had both of them. But the experience of becoming a father, you know, watching your child come into the world is kind of factual. And there's nothing about the experience of birth necessarily that gives you a whole lot of insight other than to say, whoa, that was awesome. I guess things have changed now.
No.
The losing of a father, though, that's a rite of passage with a lot of intensity and depth to it.
Yeah, Freud called it the most poignant of all losses, the death of a father for his son. And I kind of agree, although I'm still working through it. So my father only died a year ago, so I'm still kind of dealing with it. You know, I think both of those experiences, though, I had them actually at the same time. My second daughter was born about 20 days before my father died. And it's not so much that you learn something. It's that your position in the universe changes, if you know what I mean. Like, it's not that you gain some kind of insight. It's just that all of your relationships and how you think of yourself and how others think of you and how you think of the world is just altered, like just cracked, and then you try and figure out what that means, and that process takes, I think, a long life. You know, I think that process takes your life.
There's a couple of things in thinking about what you wrote for Esquire, which is terrific, by the way, and just this, the idea of these statistics you just rattled off.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting to me that, okay, the time that men are spending with children has tripled since 1965, and they want kids more than women. Suspects, although the statistics probably don't necessarily go together, that, you know, men have had quality time with the kids since 1965, so therefore they're pretty positive about how things have changed. Would you agree?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, and when you compare it to, like, the statistics on, like, housework, like, men haven't done any more housework since about 1980. Like,
right.
It's really just stopped there. But fatherhood, though, men took to immediately. it's become very clear, and it's becoming more and more clear, that spending time with your children is actually part of the good life. You know, it's not a burden, and it's a pleasure. And that I think, is the real change that has happened.
I'm wondering, on this Father's Day, do you miss your dad?
Oh, yeah, immensely. I mean, but, you know, on the other hand, he was just such a great father, and I'm just so glad I had so much time with him. And also, you know, he wasn't one of those absent dads. I mean, he loved being a father, and I knew what being a father was without having to think about it too much because of who my dad was. And, you know, that's just an amazing gift. That's just an amazing gift that I was given in my life. And, you know, the best advice, you know, the advice my father did give me was, don't listen to any advice. And, you know, another piece of advice he gave me was, you can't love your children too much. That last one to me is actually the key. You know, like, you go to, you know, you're when you're a father, you're obsessed with all these minor questions, breastfeeding, you know, what is the appropriate age to start taking them to Taekwondo, like all of these little negligible things. And then you go to the schoolyard, and what you see are really like kids who've been loved enough and kids who haven't been loved enough. And those are really the two sort of broad categories. And I think on those two major points, I think I'm doing pretty well.
What are you going to do with that new necktie?
I don't know. I don't know what I'm getting. I got a flower last year that I planted in the garden and did pretty well. I like that one. How about you? What do you get from like five kids? I mean, that must be a haul.
Oh, you know what I get? Every Father's Day morning, I'm sleeping in, I get this like chorus of five jumping on the bed.
Right.
And they, you know, all these sort of things they drop, you know, here, look at this. I made this picture, you know, here's a song.
Wow.
So
that must be like a love bomb.
Yeah, it is. It's
my gosh. It's five just, kids on Father's Day.
Yeah.
Wow.
Kaboom.
Kaboom.
Stephen, thanks so much.
Total pleasure.
Stephen Marsh, novelist and contributing editor for Esquire. Happy Father's Day.
Happy Father's Day.
Hey there, you guys. As we approach this Father's Day weekend, does your dad still have the capacity to surprise?
Shortly after my 18th birthday, my dad sat my older brother and myself down and told us he essentially had a love child in the 70s, and the child was put up for adoption, a surprise older half-brother.
That's Matt in Portland. Thanks for that. Can you top that, Judy?
This is Judy in Everett, Washington. When I was in high school, I was cleaning out a basement closet and found some old newspaper articles from the 1940s. They featured my dad, who had caused two auto collisions two weekends in a row. The cause was drunken driving, and the second accident resulted in the death of his date.
And Paula from Plano, Texas, shared this story with us.
When I was young, in my teenage years, I was sitting around talking with my older sisters, and my oldest sister commented that when she was a child, had come upon a box of photographs, just absolutely horrific pictures. She later asked my dad where the pictures had come from, and my dad, it turned out, had been a part of a group that had opened up and liberated a German concentration camp.
Thanks for all the stories. We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Weigh in at thetakeaway.org. Happy Father's Day, folks, and thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.